Let's go back to our lens and let's take it back to know-it-all and think-they-know-it-all behavior. Now, the difference between know-it-all and think-they-know-it-all is true know-it-all does know what they're talking about. The think-they-know-it-all does not know what they're talking about. That's the essential difference. What's operating in both those behaviors is ego, is right there on the surface. And, you know, people can go right from one to the other. You could be in a conversation where somebody really does know the subject, and they're dominating as a know-it-all. And then as conversations go, the subject changes and to something else that they don't know, and they keep going as if they do. They have now switched into think-they-know-it-all. People can go right from one behavior to another to another. In fact, sometimes you actually have to chase people through two or three behaviors before you get them back into the yellow or the green. That's very common. But think-they-know-it-all is definitely a bit of ego gone mad. It's all about needing to be the center of attention. This is where one-upsmanship is going to appear. You know, if you were sick, they were sick, or you had a great vacation, theirs was greater, all that kind of stuff. So our goal usually with think-they-know-it-all behavior is to derail bad ideas. We want to give bad ideas the hook. As in vaudeville, we get a hook out before it does any serious damage. Because the danger of think-they-know-it-all behavior is they can make a bad idea sound good because they'll speak with such confidence, and if the group doesn't know the difference, they fall them over a cliff and into the sea. So let's say we're at a meeting here. We're going to do some publishing on the World Wide Web. One person at the meeting says, well, you know, I think we have to take a look at the Intel Max by Apple because, and before they get any further, in but to think they know it all, are we talking computers, are we talking fruit? I'll have you know, I'm a computer expert. I've had a personal computer for 3 years now. That's right, I'm a monster user. My computer runs software. Now, let me educate you about computers, because I've not only done undergraduate work, I've done overgraduate work. Things are always changing in technologies. I mean, think of disks. Started with, you had big disks, and then you got little ones, DD, dinky disks. And then they went to HD, it's only half the disk. CD, you listen to music. DVD, you watch a movie. Oh my, how can you keep up with it? Let me tell you one thing. We got to get something that runs the big disks, because we got big information. We need a big disk to put it on. And then another thing. Yes, you got to give them credit that the Mac pioneered the ooey gooey graphic user interface. But through the magic of software, everyone's got pictures to punch. You pop in the program doors, away you go. And we certainly want the system to be IBM computable. Because if we're IBM computable, we can get on the interweb. We can listen to downcasts. Authorize me $1 million, I'll buy for everyone. All right. Now, I am really relieved to hear you laugh, because I've done that routine in places. It's here in the United States where people don't laugh. They suddenly start taking more notes. Ooh, I was going shopping this weekend. What a coincidence. That's really true. Yeah, got a few states up into the west. Now, but this is what makes them dangerous, because they will speak with such surety that you can fall them over a cliff. So our primary goal when we face think-they-know-it-all behaviors is to give that bad idea the hook. Let's derail the idea. Now, contrary to popular belief, the quickest way to stop a think-they-know-it-all in their tracks is not the Vulcan nerve pinch. It's really just give them some recognition. But we can't acknowledge the content of their communication, so instead, we're going to acknowledge intent. And this is Pygmalion power. It's when you project positive intent, when you act like people have the best of intentions, whether or not that's true. So, in this scenario, we could say, well, thank you for sharing your computer knowledge with the group. I appreciate you want us to get the right system for our needs. See, this stops them cold, because they bask in the glory of it. Hey, no problemo. After all, it's deciduous to my species. And then you start innocently asking questions. So, how many K do you get on a big disk versus a dinky disk? Well, I don't recall, but on the big disk, it's special K. You don't back them into a corner too quick, or the only defense is to get more sure of themselves. You be innocent and curious. You ask questions. You can use documentation, as we did with our true know-it-all. Documentation always is good, because it's not your opinion versus theirs. It's something neutral, third party. You know, with a know-it-all, when you present documentation, usually you give them the benefit of the doubt. You would say, of course you've read I'm sure you're aware of. With a think they know it all, you don't have to do that. You could just, but you want to be a little indirect. Indirect means I was wondering, what do you suppose? I think, maybe. You know, I think the program that creates the graphic user interface, according to what I read, for IBM compatibles is Windows. Are you aware of what level of CPU we'll need to run the latest version of Windows? No. The CPU is busy. Meet with the board of directors running the company. Fall back on the dock. I think I was reading the latest issue of Nut that 68% of all publishing on the World Wide Web is being done on a Macintosh. Army is switching from Windows NT servers to Macs. They find it much more secure against break-ins. Were you aware there's over 200,000 Windows viruses? There haven't been one for the Mac platform really in 10 years, and there's only been 64 over 30 years, and most of those are 10 years old. According to McAfee, January 2010, there are 127,000 malware programs out there. Only 7 are aimed at the Mac platform. And, of course, with the new Intel processors, that actually allows us to run our Windows software we already have side by side on the same computer, thereby preserving our previous software investment. Now you have them in your headlights. But resist the temptation to run them down. Maybe you haven't read that issue yet. Oh, no! See, that must have been the latest issue. No, I've been so busy, I let my subscription perspire. Think they know it all is not attached to the idea. Because it's not about the idea. It's about what people will think. And so, if slowly but surely they hear you know what you're talking about, and you give them a way to go along with you, that's the way they're going to go. If you just spoke documentation, you couldn't be more perfectly set up to say maybe you haven't read that yet. See, you want to be indirect and slowly but surely let them know you know what you're talking about, because if you're too direct, then that could just force them into a corner of being more sure of themselves. And again, if other people don't know, they could lead them astray. So you be indirect, you take your time, and then at the end you give them a way to go along with you. And, of course, saying maybe you haven't read that yet is a good strategy, but you can also just jump right back to number one. But thank you for speaking up. You know what? I appreciate it because you really jogged my memory. Well, thank you. That's what I like to do. Stimulate discussion till we all agree and we make an anonymous decision. Now, that handles this in the moment. But long term, we may need to take another step here. Now, with all our behaviors, you know, we have to deal with the behavior here now in the short term, but ultimately we'd like to have more of a long-term effect on the behavior if we can, depending on how much we interact with this person. Now, how that occurs is really different for the different behaviors. With tank behavior, if you have one good interaction with them, where you really stand up to them appropriately, assertively, not as aggressive as they are, but not passive, very often that creates a long-term effect with you. It will not change how they respond to anybody else, but it will change with you. The short term becomes an immediate long-term effect. With sniping, it's really two separate strategies. One is, first of all, with sniping, we've got to call attention to it in the moment with the stop, look, and backtrack, or the relevancy, what's really going on. But then, after that's done, and at another time, we need to clear the air. We need to find out what's going on. If there's something going on between us, it's time to clear the air. Now, you know, sometimes clearing the air has got nothing to do with you. In fact, let's go back to sniping for a moment. I remember meeting a psychiatric nurse, first day on a new job. She meets a sarcastic doctor, couldn't believe how he spoke to her. Give him the benefit of the doubt, she pulled him aside privately and said, listen, we're both professionals here. We're going to act professionally. We're going to speak professionally. And you're never going to use that tone of voice with me again. Is that clear? He said, I'm sorry. And he wouldn't do it with her, but he would do it with anyone else who let him get away with it. Well, this nurse had to attend a meeting with this doctor each week. And at this meeting was another nurse who was being a nothing person. She wouldn't say anything. So the doctor was especially ruthless with her. Finally, at one of these meetings, the psychiatric nurse has just had enough. Right after the doctor makes a comment, she turns to the nothing nurse and says, you know, I think it's rude and unprofessional for him to speak to you this way, but why? What I find even more crazy is you sit every week and take it. If I were you, I would come to these meetings with a loaded squirt gun, and if he talks like that, psst. He went, I'm sorry, sorry. And then a funny thing happened. Next meeting, when he started to become sarcastic, a couple of other people in the meeting went, squirt gun time, squirt gun time. and they retrained him out of that behavior. Now, he did not have a specific personal issue with anyone specifically. It was about just his pent-up frustration and stress that was suppressed that led to the sniping. So coming back to that short-term, long-term, in the short-term, we deal with the sniping, but in the long-term, we need to clear the air. If there's a grievance, we need to clear the air, whether it's a third party, or maybe we just need to bring it to that person's attention. Taking know-it-all behavior, it happens in a little different way in that the short-term evolves into a long-term effect. You see, with our know-it-all, we're never directly challenging them. In fact, we are asking a lot of questions, and when people go into a know-it-all mode, they love to be asked questions because it lets them be the authority answering your questions. Now, remember how with the tank, we had to set them up with intent? All right, in order to solve a problem fast, I need to ask them questions. You have to be really careful if you're going to ask questions of the tank. You don't have to do anything with a know-it-all. They're happy to answer your questions from now till the cows come home. You don't have to set them up at all, because when people are in a know-it-all mode, they're not in a hurry. Even though it's still controlling behavior, they're not in a hurry. So you can ask all the questions you need to find out the information you need. And so what's happening as we slip our ideas through and they work out, the know-it-all notes that and raises us in their esteem. And something else works out and raises us in their esteem. And we're never really showing up as a bogey on their radar. And so eventually, they treat us as equal know-it-all status. Now, with our think-they-know-it-all here that we're on now, it's going to be two separate strategies. One is we got to derail the bad idea here and now. But in the long term, what we have to do is quench a thirst for recognition. Its behavior is like a thirst. See, they need attention, so they tend to exaggerate, stretch the truth, puff themselves up. Eventually, people start becoming aware of what they're doing. So even if they deserve some recognition and attention, they tend not to get it because we say, their head is swollen enough already. We don't want it to pop. So therefore, they need it even more. So they do the behavior more, so we give it even less. Need it more, do it more, give it less. Need it more, do it more, give it less. And around we all go. A relative behavior that you will read about in the Relatives book, the martyr. Okay, the martyr actually happens right down here on the border of get along and get appreciated. In that the martyr is doing all these nice things for family members. Doing, taking care of everybody and everything. Get along. But what they also really want is the appreciation and the significance of doing that. The trap that's easy for somebody who's doing martyr to fall into is the things they're doing for the family members are nothing the family members want them to do. So therefore, they're not getting the appreciation they're unconsciously seeking. So they need it even more. So they try even harder to do even more. So we give it even less. Need it more, do it more, give it less, and around we go. So staying with martyr for a moment, what you want to do is quench that thirst. You want to consider, stop and consider, what could they do for me that I would really appreciate, that would be just terrific, and I would genuinely appreciate? Then you go into a conversation with them, private conversation, where you say, listen, this and this, not so good, and I would rather you didn't do that, but don't dwell on what's negative. But, well, you know, it would be great if you could do this. Oh, God, that would be so great. I'd be so grateful. Oh, sure, they'll be happy to do that. And then you'll be able to genuinely give them the appreciation they seek. So now going back to our know-it-all, it's the same exact theme. We want to give them the recognition they deserve. They're just what they deserve. You don't want to make up stuff. But as soon as you are ready to look for recognition, you assume they deserve it, doot, 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 doot. There's one. Doot, doot, doot. Hey, good job. Doot, doot. Hey, great. You will start seeing. Your reticular activating system will show you those opportunities. And for some, that will completely handle it. And from others, maybe you're going to have to take one more step, which is be honest with them. Da-da-da-da. Now, I bring up honesty at this moment, but honesty is not limited to think they know it all behavior. You can be honest with anybody about their behavior. I just bring it up now in the context of this to make them feel important. Now, do you remember what it is if you don't want people to take things the wrong way? What does that a signal for? Positive intent. Anytime you're worried about people taking things the wrong way, it's time for positive intent. So if you're going to be honest with somebody, I mean, just imagine you have to give somebody some feedback. Listen, some of your team members have been complaining about, hey, I'm a team player, da-da-da-da. They'll immediately start defending themselves. If you want to nip that in the bud, you say, listen, I know you're a team player. I know you really care about your team members. What are they going to say now? Oh, no, you're wrong. I love annoying people. In fact, I keep a section of my day planner. Today's a new record. Woo! The only response to a positive projection is, of course, whenever you positive project, think of it like you're giving people a shove, and they will step in that direction. They will automatically go in that direction. Now, so what you're going to do is really, if you're going to be honest with people, you have to make it safe. And the way you make it safe is you start out, first of all, by projecting positive intent on them. Listen, I know you care about your team members. I know you're a real team player. And then you got to stop and breathe. Because you don't want to butt here at all, and you don't want to rush. In fact, whenever you give good blending, train yourself to stop and take one breath. Just like that. You want to let that blending sink in. Give people that moment. Then, after one breath, you come back with, and I'd like to share with you something that I think will support you in that endeavor. Now, we be clear about our intent. Our intent is not to give them their daily adult dose of abuse. Our intent is to support them. They care about teamwork. I care about them. Everybody's caring here. And then from there, that becomes safe to talk about the specifics of behavior. And that's what we need to get into, behavioral specifics. We can't talk about generalizations. You know, if you say to somebody, all right, I need you to be more committed as a team member, what's going to happen is they will go out and do their definition of what more committed is. But unfortunately, that is probably not what you're cluing into. You're looking at certain behaviors that either have to stop or some other behaviors that have to start or some combination thereof. But we sum it up with a thing called commitment. You will never, in any kind of performance feedback situation, you must be behaviorally specific. If you're not, you're doomed. Because this person, if we leave it at a level of generalization, which I call the word commitment a generalization, they'll go out and do their definition. 1 month later, you get back together, you say, listen, I need you to be more committed. There they are trying for a month, and you're going to set yourself back. In fact, I mentioned to you there's some things in today's program that are going to save you a lot of trouble. And one of them is behavioral definition. So far, I mentioned tone of voice. When there's a tone mismatch, your words are canceled out, so you monitor your tone. Second is listening and having people feel understood. Do that first. That opens their mind. The third one is intent. Anytime you're worried about people taking things the wrong way, you know it's time for positive intent. And the fourth one here is behavioral definitions. These behaviors equals this definition. So, for example, I remember Rick and I once found out that we had totally different strategies for dealing with upset. If he was upset, what he really wants is somebody to jump in, process him through it, force him to deal with it. If I'm upset, I like people to leave me alone. So, of course, if he got upset, I would leave him alone. And he'd feel abandoned when he needed somebody. And if I got upset, he would annoy me with questions. The day we found out this about each other, I asked my wife that night, how would you know if I really supported you in your career? Because she said I didn't, and I said I did, and also vice versa. Sure enough, behavioral definitions. Support for her was validation. Validation. Support for me was logistics and space. So as an artist, I was giving her logistics and space. Do what you got to do. I don't understand art. In fact, negative validation. And I think I'm really supporting, according to my definition, and she's giving me all this validation. I'm like, yeah, well, I got to be gone for a week. What? Well, I need some space. I got to go. You want to do to others, you want them to do to you, but it's got to be the way they understand. If it's not in the way they understand, you haven't quite landed it yet. You always know it's time to ask these two magic questions. If somebody says to you, you don't blank, and you fill in your favorite one, you don't love me, care, support, whatever, and you know you do, then you say, start out with, I really want to, statement of intent, because we don't want them to misunderstand. Then you say, how would you know if I did support, love, care, whatever that is? And then you backtrack, clarify, backtrack, clarify, backtrack, clarify until you got the specific definition. And then go to the negative, how do you know that I don't? Backtrack, clarify, backtrack, clarify, backtrack, clarify. It's safer to do the positive before the negative, because if you ask, how do you know that I don't, it could sound like a challenge. Obviously, your tone of voice is everything here. But that you're also adding the extra safety precaution of a statement of intent. Yes, I really want to. How would you know if I did? And then how do you know what I don't? The issue could be one or the other. You know, maybe you're doing something that to them means non-support, or maybe you're not doing something that would mean support, or maybe there's some combination thereof. This is behavioral definitions. Let me give you the last one. Usually we would do this in the context of the know-it-all, but we had to get Rick on his plane here. This is the last of the big five, and this is criteria. Once upon a time, I'm in my office with a couple. It's the end of the visit. Everybody's feeling really good. All of a sudden, she suddenly turns to him and says, "Honey, let's go to the Rose Gardens." And he says, "Nah." And she says, "Okay." And I say, wait a second. What's your intent right now? Why did you bring this up? She says, "Well, we're feeling close. We have a long time. We have an hour before to pick up the kids. I thought it'd be nice to spend some quiet time together." He goes, "Oh, that's a great idea. I don't want to be outside. Too hot, too buggy. How about the cafe we've been meaning to try?" She says, "Sure." Now, I ask you, studio audience, does she care about going to the Rose Gardens? No, she cares about spending time together. In this case, that's intent, overall purpose. Rose Gardens, just a way to fulfill the purpose. But why Rose Gardens? Why not dinner for two or a movie or cruise? The answer is criteria. Guess what the criteria might be in this case? What do you think? Convenience, okay? There's a time criterion, so maybe it's on the way home. So the geography goes along with that time criterion. Hey, what? How much it costs? Very good budgetary criteria. Maybe it's a romantic, quiet place. Atmospheric criteria. You know, whenever actually people have an idea, what the seed of the idea is an intent. Then they run the intent through the criteria, and out pops the idea. But rarely do we as human beings communicate clearly, which is our intent and criteria. She just spontaneously says, "Honey, let's go to the Rose Gardens," and he thinks, "Nah." Once he gets time together, oh, now he understands the intent. He adds a few more criteria in the mix: be indoors, avoid bugs, heat, and it becomes cafe. But now consider this: what if the cafe is a noisy dive? What if her highly valued criterion is a romantic, quiet place? Well, then what's going to happen is, if she doesn't know his criteria, or if he doesn't know hers, he will not understand why she promptly rejects the cafe and again says Rose Gardens. And if she doesn't know his, she won't understand why he rejects Rose Gardens, says cafe. And it's an everyday communication trap we fall into. We do not specify intent or criteria. We simply leave it on the surface and say, Rose Gardens, cafe. 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 There goes a good piece of work I just did. But in life, there's always a bright side. At least I get to do another visit with them. All right, I admit it. When I work with couples, I'm like the officials in a hockey game. Let them fight for a while. All right, you two. Penalty. Schedule next week. Ching, ching. However, once they get all the criteria, they come up with a compromise. It's not a compromise. It's an integration. And try to make criteria visual. Now, I mentioned earlier, we're going to talk about visual communication. Visual is something that you see. Auditory is something that you hear. When I write the word visual up there, it's visual. When I say it to you, it's auditory. Visual has two powers that auditory does not. One is it remains over time. I put that word X number of moments ago, and it's still in the room. If we go back to third-party sniping, I told you about the ex-couple fighting over their kid, and when I established their intent, we're here in the best interest of David. That was immediately made visual on the whiteboard on purpose because I wanted that in our consciousness at all times. It remains over time. The second thing that auditory does that visual does that auditory cannot, totality of concept. You can see totality. So, for example, it fits within an hour. It's on the way home. It doesn't cost anything. It's a quiet setting. We can't hear those all simultaneously, but we can see the big picture simultaneously. So here's a scenario for you. Take note of this. So once upon a time, there's a new policy. The team is in the conference room with their boss, asking questions about the new policy, and somebody spontaneously goes up to the whiteboard, and as they find out the boss's criteria for this policy, they start writing those criteria on the whiteboard with real words, not lines. That just represents it. Now, so far, so good. Anytime you take notes in a way that people can see it, it's like backtracking to the 10th power. Backtracking to the 10th power, because they see it, they see you see it, so they get you get it. Well, the next thing they happen is they go, but what we think is this, this, and this. They made a new column, changed color, added three criteria. Now look at it. Doesn't it look like it's the red team versus the blue team? We've made this look like opposition. Whether or not that's true doesn't matter. We've made it look that way. Not to mention the transition from blending to leading was with a but. Anytime you lead with a but, it sounds like you're going to contradict where you just came from. In fact, what you want to do is sit on your butt but don't say it. We're going to breathe through that moment. So, boss, this, and this is important. Join me. Now, usually we don't breathe when we transition from lending to leading because we're too much in a rush to lead. You don't want people to jump in the space and say something. I think you're wasting your time if you try to lead before people are ready to hear you. What you want to do is grab people by the ankles and hold them upside down and empty them out until they have nothing left to do but listen to you. So in a way, breathing not only lets blending sink in, you're testing the water. Are they ready to be led yet? Because if they don't say anything, you can assume readiness. So again, so boss, this is important. And what we also think is important to consider is this. And also, in addition to, not in contradiction, one column of criteria in the same color. Now we're looking at all these factors, and it's more likely we come up with a totality. In the context of any kind of meeting, this is going to be critical, that you make people's ideas visual. Whatever they contributed to a meeting must be recorded in a visual manner. Have you ever heard somebody repeat themselves at a meeting? Have you ever heard somebody repeat themselves? Have you ever heard somebody repeat themselves? Have you? All right. If a meeting is done on an auditory level, and I have an important concept, I'm going to say it a number of times as a way of keeping in people's awareness. If I say it, it's up there. I see it. I see you see it. 10 minutes later, it's still there. I don't need to repeat myself. You will. In fact, we don't have time in today's program to get deep into meetings, but those of you who give the email, we'll give you an article series, and the first article you'll get is Conscious Communication at Meetings, the Meeting Magic Process, and it'll tell you how to apply this. And it's going to neutralize all 10 behaviors in a meeting. They can't even occur. You don't even have to deal with them, as well as keeping meetings shorter and more focused. In fact, some Boeing engineers used to have a three-hour meeting every Wednesday morning. They got the article, they did the process, and they got their meeting done in less than 90 minutes. But that's not what stunned them. What stunned them was that they got more done at a higher quality than they ever could do in 3 hours. The only person who didn't like it was the know-it-all, because he couldn't dominate any longer. All right, let's to understand our next behavior from the inside out, everybody crinkle up your forehead like this. Put the weight of the world on your shoulders and repeat after me. He's making me do this. Way together. 1, 2, 3. He's making me do this. Oh, that was okay. All right, try this one. Fold up your arms. Cock your head back. Be really sure yourself to the point of know-it-all arrogance. Shake your head and say, forget it. It that didn't take any prodding. It's hopeless. Nothing ever changes. Now, is there a difference here? Feel it in your body. Unfold, crinkle, and slump. Repeat after me. Oh, the person who should be hearing this seminar isn't. 1, 2, 3. Oh, the person who should be hearing this seminar isn't. Right? Okay, good. Now fold up your arms again. Cock your head back. Get a little head action going and state your motto. I'm not being negative. I'm being realistic. This is whining. This is negativity. This is helpless, but maybe if I annoy you, you'll do something. This is hopeless. Same genus, different species. And in a way, negativity is fossilized whining. So, what applies to one tends to apply to the other. We're going to look at our whiner slide. Now, everything on this slide also applies to negativity. This is your first round. Your goal is to get them to problem solve. See, the root of whining is a feeling of being helpless. The root of negativity is a feeling of being hopeless. If you just take care of that, you don't address it. But if you can get them to problem solve, that specifically addresses a feeling of being helpless and hopeless, and that can get whining or negativity to go away. Now, with somebody who you consider your client or customer, you know, for those your teachers, you have a parent or whatever, You're not so much, you are going to take care of a problem they have, but educating them about how to prevent problems and what they can do in the future is really right, because that empowers them to avoid these pitfalls in the future. Ultimately, one way or another, you're wanting to empower them. So unfortunately, the bad news here is you're going to have to begin by listening. But then it'll be time to interrupt. How will you know it's time to interrupt them? How will you know it's time to interrupt them? How will you know it's time to interrupt them? When they repeat themselves. All right. When people get whiny or negative, they go in endless loop tapes. They'll go around as many times as you allow them. Give them one complete loop, but when you're hearing something you've already heard in this sitting, treat that as a signal to get more involved. You say, excuse me for interrupting. Then a statement of intent. Just want to make sure I understand. So you're saying, and now you give a complete backtrack summary of what you've heard so far. Then you start to clarify, because people whine in big generalizations, but we need specifics to problem solve. However, what will happen next is generalization swapping. So when you say, okay, what's wrong? And they'll go, everything's wrong. Okay, but what specifically is wrong? Well, all of it. When does it occur? It happens all the time. Who's doing it? Everybody. And what have you tried? Everybody. You've been there, huh? Par for the course, you're going to go five, if not seven questions, spinning your wheels, going nowhere. You've got to be ready for this, because otherwise the generalization point is going to work on you. After three, you're going to generalize that they're never going to be specific, and you're going to offer a solution. Do not do that. Your goal is to outlast them. Even if that requires the recycling of questions already asked, that's okay. See, again, generalization point. Two or three red lights, all lights are red. This is actually the etiology of whining and negativity. They have two or three that become everybody, all the time, everything. Now, some people just do this acutely, meaning that, in general, this person's not a whiner, but they have a few things that went wrong today, and now they got a 48-hour whining virus. Whereas other people do this much more chronically. They've had significant disappointments in their life, and now they're running their whole life like this. And remember, once you start, you form the generalization, you selectively sort your perceptions. This is why people who are chronically negative say, I'm not being negative, I'm being realistic, because they've been selectively sorting so long. So your goal is to outlast them. So you ask, and finally you hit bottom. You're looking at specifics of a real problem, and you may know what to do, but don't say it. Well, what do you think we should do? What do you want? You got to get them to think solutions, and a lot of them will go, well, I guess we should, and they'll bring in something that makes such sense, you'll be stunned. How could they have just said, I don't know, you know, how could they have not said this before? The reason is people can only pay attention to seven things at once consciously. If I am looking at the generalization that everything is wrong, I cannot problem solve a generalization. Once my attention is looking at specifics, then it's possible to take the next step. Other people at the same point in the strategy may want something that's valid but unrealistic. I'm doing the work of three people. I want two more people. If that ain't going to happen, then you say, well, we both know Ebenezer's not going to go for that. So in that case, what do you want? So you reflect reality as it is and ask again and stay in that loop until what they want becomes realistic. Other people at this stage, you'll discover, are venting. I just need to get out of my system. Oh, you're venting. Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead. You got 5 minutes. Go. This is critical that you do this, because the difference between venting and wallowing is venting is done intentionally to feel better. Venting has a time frame, an end point. Whereas wallowing goes on and on unconsciously with no intention and no time frame. So at the end of 5 minutes, you'll go, eh, time's up. Now what do you want? Other people at the stage will go, I don't know. You ever hear it, I don't know? Of course, this is the nothing person's first response on a good day. I don't know. Here's what works with I don't knows. You can do this with anybody at home, school, or office. You say to them, guess, make something up. If you did know, what would it be? And then give an expectant look like this. If you want to experience the power of the expectant look with nothing behavior, get on a crowded elevator, pick out a stranger at random, and go. They confess all kinds of funny things. You gotta entertain yourself on the road. Now, I'm kidding about the elevator, but I'm definitely not kidding about the look. In fact, all of us have an expectant look. Every time you ask a question, you naturally follow with an expectant look. What I'm suggesting you do is purposely turn up the dial about 15% on your expectant look and hold it in an expectant pause. And it's amazing how 9 out of 10 people who just told you, I don't know, will go, well, I guess, and they'll bring in something that makes total sense. For the 1 in 10 that does not respond to that, you still got a trick up your sleeve. You exaggerate. I was in a couple seminar once. A lady said, he leaves too many glasses in the sink. I said, really? How many? How often? She says, too many, too often. I said, yeah, but give me a number here. She goes, oh, I don't know. I said, guess. She says, too many, too often. I said, 50 glasses a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year. She goes, no. 3 glasses 4 times a week. Where were those numbers a moment ago? I was talking to a surveyor. I said, how much will this cost? He says, I don't know. It's hard to say. I said, $50, $5,000. He goes, oh, no, $500. It's weird but true, and I know you've done it. So if this person who's whining cannot think of a solution, then maybe you should suggest, what if we were to just kill every other department? Okay. Ooh, can I help? Yes, you can help. And you do want them to help, and that's part of empowering them. You're going to assign or suggest, and of course that depends what's your relationship. Assign or suggest ways for them to be involved in the solution, and then you always leave them with something to look forward to. And next week we will do this. Now, if you're ever back at step number 2, clarifying you can't get people to be specific, then merely jump right to number 4 and assign or suggest that the next week they write down every time this occurs, who's there, what's going on, and then next Friday we'll get together and see what you got. That becomes the process. You'll handle a majority of whining with 1 through 5. You'll handle a minority of negativity with 1 through 5. But there's that highly virulent strain that's really committed to being miserable. So they'll resist you every step of the way. And at one point, you're just going to draw a line and say, look, if you don't want to think solutions, that's fine. When you change your mind, just let me know. And if they keep complaining, you go, la, 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 and you hold that line. Because as people start bumping up against a line like that, it's not as much fun to whine anymore. Because misery loves company. Now, with negativity, that's a little bit further gone. Because negativity has all the arrogance of a know-it-all seduced by the dark side of the force. So you'll do all of that, but if they resist you, your next step, goal, is to survive the negativity. And so one of the ways you can do that is you can give yourself an attitude adjustment by using them as a resource. So I remember once, actually, this was a seminar Rick and I did probably 20 years ago in Toledo, Ohio. A woman there says, her husband Bob is terribly negative, always what's wrong, never what's right. The Cub Scouts are planning a trip to Washington, D.C. The organizers are wondering, gee, could anything go wrong? They look at each other and go, let's call Bob in on a planning meeting. So they bring in her husband, Bob, knowing what he's going to do, and sure enough, he starts ripping the trip apart. Really, Bob, what makes you say that? Backtrack, clarify, backtrack, clarify, backtrack, clarify, ad nauseum, as we did with our whiner. Then we'll say, thank you, Bob, see you later, and we sort for ourselves what's exaggerated, what's something we should attend to. This doesn't change the negative person, but it changes things for you, because you're harnessing their negativity for the greater good. Now, polarity. Polarity means opposite. So the worst thing you can ever do if somebody's being negative is try to tell them it's not so bad. Because then they're going to go deeper into how bad it is. 2-year-olds tend to have a polarity response as a developmental phase. Time for bed. I don't want to go to bed. Time for bed. I don't want to go to bed. All right, but if you stay up, you got to stay up the whole night. What if I get tired? Teenagers can go through a developmental phase of polarity, and when people are negative, they have polarity. So the place you have to watch out for this the most is in your personal relationships, because there, out of genuine caring, you're going to want to offer solutions, tell them it's not so bad, but ironically, you're pushing them deeper into their quicksand. You'd be better if you did nothing, but if you really want to have some fun and do something, then what you do is you jump into the quicksand with them and start playfully splashing around. You're right, it's hopeless. I don't know why we bother. We might as well end it all right now. Nothing's ever going to change. Nothing's ever going to work. And they'll go, well, you're right about that, but all you have to do is this, and they will offer you a solution. That is amazing how that works with negativity, like a charm consistently. Does not work with whining. When people are whiny, they are not polarized. But when people are negative, they're more fixed, and so you can purposely play their polarity. But if nothing else, you want to watch and not inadvertently play their polarity. Projecting positive intent works as good with whining as it does with negativity. That's when you act like they're whining your negativity. Is there with some positive, constructive purpose? So one of my great loves has always been hockey. I now play gym hockey, plastic sticks and with a felt puck. We run around in sneakers at a gymnasium. It's a half of us are from cities in the Northeast, and the other half are Russians. There's Vladimir and Boris and Alex and Alex and Alex and Alex and Alex. And so we had to kind of sort out our Alexes. So every Alex has a unique first name. There's Big Alex because of his size. There's Red Alex because of his hair color. And there's Negative Alex because of his attitude. Oh, what? You cannot pass perfect language. I need to speak to you. Get past. You, broken leg, cannot run. What? Always what's wrong. Never what's right. But I did notice something about Negative Alex. He liked to play hockey in that get-it-right quadrant. For him, it wasn't about winning. It was about a good game. He didn't want to accidentally score a goal. He wanted to make a pretty play. This was really brought home to me a time we played a group of Canadian chiropractic students. Okay, now me and the Russians and most of us who play were not really raised in organized hockey. These Canadians obviously learned organized hockey because we were 5 minutes into the game and they had five goals. So there's a stoppage in play. Negative Alex comes staggering over to me, dripping sweat, and says, "Eric, this is a real game, no?" See, he didn't care they were killing us because they knew how to do it right. Now, I felt the same way he did. I like to play the same way. So we got along well in that manner. We also had an equal skill level, so he had nothing to complain about my play. And we also just had that unique chemistry where I passed to where I thought he'd be and he'd be there. So even though most of the time the games are choose up sides, we go to a whiteboard, we try to make fair teams, he and I would always put each other on the same team. And then unfortunately, everybody would put themselves on the other team because nobody wanted to be with him. He was so critical. All right, so one time I just casually happened to say to him, "Hey, Alex, I think it's great how much you care about people learning to play better." He goes, "What?" I said, "You obviously care a lot. You always spend a lot of time telling people what they do wrong. Why would you waste the time if you didn't want to learn what to do right, right?" He goes, "I suppose." Now, if you're going to project positive, you have to be consistent over time and genuine. And given that he and I were always on the same team, what I started doing is whenever he complained about somebody, I would project positive by saying, "Thanks for telling him. Now he knows what to do next time." Or, "Soon we'll all be passing the puck." Or, "We'll teach these people eventually." Implying this is what we're trying to achieve. After 3 weeks of doing it twice a week, 2 hours a night, I want to test if the seed has sprouted. I say, "Alex, you're a guy who cares a lot about people learning, aren't you?" He goes, "Da, this is true, so." Now he's ready for feedback. "Alex, have you noticed that people are not getting any better?" He gets real serious. "Da, Rick, you think they're all stupid?" I said, "I don't know, but if what you're doing isn't working, you do something else. Let's only tell them for 2 weeks as an experiment what they should do instead of what they shouldn't." He went up there, he did that. They started to change their behavior. His behavior started to go along with that. It took about 2 months. He was no longer Negative Alex anymore. This is called projecting positive intent. You appreciate the whining negativity is there because they care. They have a high standard of perfection. They want to make things better. Now, group whining and negativity. Okay? Remember, those are two of the behaviors that spread like the flu, and before you know it, everybody's in a habit of doing it. So we have two courses of action. One is, can we somehow empower people? The other is to simply break this habit. So let's look at empowering people and go back to this slide. I meet a person in hospital administration. She tells me she inherited 17 chronic whiners. The manager before took an early retirement because she could not stand these people any longer. So this new manager comes in. She creates a trouble book. It's a big log book. If you see a problem, put your name, the date. You completely describe the problem in detail. Write three solutions. Then she would initial it so you knew it was red. And then she would be the champion for your idea in the hospital. And there was a column here. You could see where it stands, what's being done about it, what the next step is going to be. And she kept updating it all through the system. And people saw, if you put it in the book, think solution, something changes. The book became a lens through which they could affect this seemingly impossible bureaucracy around them. And she said they transformed over the course of about 2 months into 17 terrific problem solvers. Now, look at the book in terms of our strategy. She's getting them to self-clarify. They have to be specific in the book. They have to write three possible solutions. The book is the way they can affect things. They could see what the next step's going to be. That is this strategy expressed in a different form. The other alternative is breaking the habit. So one group realized, okay, we have fallen into this habit, let's break the habit. They decided to have the negativity jar. If you talked about generalized problems but no solution, anybody had the right to fine you, you had to put money in the jar. At the end of the year, they used it for a party. At the end of the first year, they had a really big party, catered, a band, everything. Then they didn't have a party next year because they broke their habit. Another group in a small government office in Alaska realized that it was a couple of generalizations that was burdening them, that nothing ever changes and nobody ever listens to our advice anyway, so what's the use? All right, so they took a page off a flip chart and they stuck it on the wall. Anytime somebody took their advice, they wrote it on a chart. Anytime something changed, they wrote it on the chart. One then became two, which became four, which became eight, which became 16, and before you knew it, the walls were papered with changes, and the attitude in the office magically changed. Because you can be winning and think you're losing if you're not keeping score. Now, remember, visual communication, the two powers, remains over time, and you see totality. All of that counterexample remained over time in such a totality it crushed those two generalizations. They could no longer exist in the face of that. You could not have crushed those generalizations verbally. No matter how many examples you gave, it would not have that same kind of impact. You definitely want to know when you want to use visual communication. So I'd ask if you have any questions, but it wouldn't do any good anyway, so we might as well just keep going through the motions here. Let's talk about our nothing people. Now, we have two nothing behaviors. We have your get-along nothing, where the theme is, if you don't have something nice to say, don't say it at all. And then we have the get-it-right nothing, which is fine. Do it your way. Don't come crying to me when it doesn't work out. So one is people-oriented, one is more task-oriented. Nothing can be hostile, as in a sniper who you ask what's wrong, and they say, nothing. Or nothing can be intimidated, as in a little child with an angry parent. The good news for you as a communicator, it doesn't really matter which it is. Whether it's get it right or get along, whether it's hostile or intimidated, your goal is exactly the same. Your goal is to get something. You're trying to get them to talk. So, in general, time is good. Nothing people are very comfortable with silence, and things move very slowly when you deal with nothing behavior. If you have any kind of deadline pressure on you, that will naturally force you to get more intense with them. But the more intense you get, the deeper you will push them into nothing. Nothing withdraws from intensity. So if you can, you can't always, but if you can, you try to pick your time and pick your place. I remember once upon a time, I came back from a trip, my wife picked me up at the airport, and she says, you're the communication expert, you deal with her. Wait, is it, what's going on? Okay, so four Siamese cats, three cat boxes, they are one serious production facility. I have no problem taking care of that, but if I'm on an extended road trip, somebody's going to pick up the slack. This is where my wife draws the line, because she does everything for everybody. So my daughter is supposed to do this. So now I'm home 15 minutes. My wife says, well, have you talked to her yet? Now, at the time, my daughter was just about 15, and it was a Friday night, and she was in a room with a couple other teenage friends. And when I looked at that context, I just had a funny intuition. This might not be the best moment to discuss the cat boxes. Told my wife, I'm going to wait for the right moment. So, Saturday rolls around. Things are just waking up. I stroll into my daughter's room. I sit down and I say, to which she says, to which my response is, and her response is, and what do you think you're doing in here? And I said, I don't know. Nothing. I mean, you know, I was gone all week and I haven't seen you. And walking by, I happened to notice you were up. I thought, maybe I should see you. Oh. Okay. This is the sound of nothing people blending. And it's very important. Immediately, a few cats come cruising in the room. What are we doing? Oh, cool, we're hanging out. Cats are great nothing people, right? They don't feel like they got to do a lot to maintain relationship. Just blink. Based on the blink, you know you're cool as far as they're concerned. Dogs are clearly hanging out in a different part of the lens of understanding. Look at you and me in the same place! This is great! Woo-hoo! I'm so happy to see you! Oh my gosh, I can't tell you how much I miss you! And I've got a terrific idea! Out, out, out! Okay, not a good idea. Better idea! Food! 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 Are you hungry? I could eat, yeah. I could always eat. What do you think? Little by little, conversation starts to form. Well, my daughter doesn't realize the conversation's going, da-dun, da-dun. But I think she does realize, because she goes right for it. She goes, look, I know I didn't do the cat boxes. I am sorry. I don't see how you can stand to do cat boxes. I thought, that's a good opening. Look at those faces. You don't want them to go to the bathroom like this. Do it for them. Or maybe you should just think of this like, panning for gold. Ooh, today I've hit the mother load. And she said, I never thought of it that way, but now I know you do. I think I'll save it all for you. Sometimes the magic works, sometimes it doesn't. But you ask open-ended questions. You give them the look. Let me see the look. Okay, just the women? Men only? Everybody! Hold the look for a longer period of time. You would be with any normal human being. In fact, bring snacks. You might need them. Take note, there's no numbers here. There's no sequence. It's just a bunch of stuff. Sometimes you show the future. That's when you connect dots for them. Because nothing people, as I said earlier, will think they're not doing anything, but they are affecting everybody else just quietly. So sometimes you connect the dots. I mean, here's a classic thing I would see in practice, especially with couples. It's the grenade nothing dance to the death. So one person's in that attention zone. The other person's more withdrawn. So this one's not getting the attention they need, so they're kind of essentially getting louder to get attention. But the louder this one gets, the further this one withdraws. But the further this one withdraws, the louder that one gets. And then they both think they're the victim of the other person's behavior, but they're really creating the other behavior. And I remember one couple came in, she was being the grenade, he was being nothing, she speaks first, he doesn't love me, when there's something I need to deal with, he just withdraws. Boom! When I finally got him to speak, he just said, she's hysterical, can you fix her, doc? Tell you what, I'll be back at 5, change the oil, rotate all the limbs. But once they understood the dynamic, it transformed their relationship. And you have to really connect the dots for them, because they're going to think they're doing nothing. Guess. I remember once a county agency in Oregon that would help teens dropping out of school, try to get them back in school, or train them for jobs and stuff. They sent one of their most hopeless nothing people to me. She had dropped out of school, was sleeping all day, wouldn't tell anybody really what was going on, wouldn't talk to me either. Just sat in my office like this. So I got out of my chair, and I said, look, I don't know what's going on for you. And I said that for two reasons. First of all, teenager, polarity, don't want to invoke polarity. Secondly, nobody likes to be told that you know what's going on. And third, if you say, I don't know, perhaps, maybe, you're hedging your bets. Anything you say next is right. Because you're saying maybe it is or maybe it isn't. So you're going to be right and blend no matter what. So I don't know what's going on for you, but if I was a teenager and I dropped out of school and I was sleeping all day, I think I'd be avoiding something. So what would I be avoiding? Something at school, something home. At home, at school, maybe I don't fit in. You know, maybe there's these cliques, I'm on the outs. The agency says, go back. I might think, I'm so far behind, I'll never catch up. Maybe I'm missing basic reading and math skills. I'm embarrassed to admit that. Let's see, at home, well, my parents haven't said anything, so I feel like they don't care. I heard you had a new step-parent. I could see how I could feel left out of that relationship. And as I just started talking out loud, stream of consciousness, no censoring, whatever occurred to me, she went like this. When you get trout mouth, you got him. But you know you got him sooner. Something flinches and moves, you're going down the right track. As soon as I saw her leg go like that, we're on the right track. What's great about guessing is you load up the shotgun at 50 guesses. It doesn't matter how much you miss. You can miss on 49 or 50 guesses. If one comes close, that's enough to bring them out. And what I really love about guessing, you can miss on all your guesses. Sometimes that's what brings them out. They feel sorry. No conception of reality. Guessing is virtually can't miss strategy, because if you come close, the jig is up. And if you don't come close, they figure you don't have a clue, I have to tell you. This is definitely what you're going to do with the sniper turn nothing. Look, maybe you resent me because of this, this, this. And if you come close, the jig is up. But if you don't come close, the sniper wants to prove what an idiot you are by telling you. So now you got something to work with, and you're going to have something. Guessing is a great strategy. And then lightening it up is a really good strategy. And I bring it up on this slide because I think with kids, you really want to try to lighten it up. Kids are here to play until the adults bum them out. But lightening it up is not limited to nothing. It works with any behavior. In fact, I'll never forget a time in a seminar, somebody told us about how he became a tank and somebody ruined it for him with humor. He had a problem with his Ford Taurus. So he went to a dealership to get it fixed and gets the car back not fixed correctly. Okay? Goes back the next time, not fixed correctly. Third time, still not fixed correctly. That's it. Fourth time, he comes in a total tank. Walks up to the service manager, says, "Listen, this is the fourth time I'm in here with the same problem. I want this car fixed right, or I'm shut up, you know what?" Although he was more anatomically explicit than I just was. The service manager looks him in the eye, says, "Oh yeah, you can try that, but you know what? I already got a Lincoln and a Mustang up there." Ruined it for him. You can't laugh and hate people at the same time. We're going to finish today with an attitude adjustment. And that attitude adjustment is perspective. The quicker you can put a person or situation in perspective, the easier it is to deal with. Now, there's two ways you can do that. One is the big picture approach, which Rick's father, Alan Kirshner, is fond of doing. 100 years from now, what difference will this make? That's big picture, because what he's doing at that moment is filling up the field of vision with 100 years and shrinking down the significance of that situation. Another way this can be done is through comparison. This was always my mother's strategy. My mother always kept the book on her shelf, Mengele, the Nazi doctor who worked on twins at Auschwitz. She kept that book on her shelf because she was a twin at Auschwitz, just misbeating Mengele. If she ever felt bad about anything, she would pull out the book, open it anywhere, read a few paragraphs, and present circumstances, not so bad. January 1945, the Russian front is now advancing very fast. The Nazis are very afraid of the Russians. They want to head west towards British or Americans if they're going to be captured. At this point, my mother was part of 1,000 girls they took on a death march through the snow. They were bringing up the rear of this German retreat. You stopped on a so-called rest break to dig a ditch in the frozen ground in the road to theoretically slow the Russian tanks down. If you're too weak, they shot you, no time to waste. But was on this march, she realized her life was in her hands. And she actually realized that by giving up at one point. One evening, then they stopped the camp. She just broke down and started to cry. German guard calls her over, "Was ist los?" She says, "I can't take it anymore. I'm freezing. I'm starving. Just kill me. I just want the war to be over." He tears the sandwich in half, hands her half, and says, "Listen, the war is almost over. We will die, you will live. You can make it. Now, just watch out for yourself. Now, I order you to go stand by that fire and guard it." The next day, she woke up with new hope and saw things that were right there all the time that she hadn't seen before. And one of these things was when they went through these evacuated German towns and the road bent in a crescent, there was a moment when the guards couldn't see you, blind spot. Then when they stopped the camp that night, she noticed that there were a lot of moments when there's no guards around because there was 1,000 girls or maybe 70 guards. So she sees one of these moments and she just gets up and just walks away. Goes down an alley, another alley, down a street, finds an abandoned house, scratches the frost off the window, and sees a Christmas tree inside. It's early January 1945. Fruit is hanging from the tree, apples. She breaks in the house, she eats this apple, and before she could feel good that she's gotten away, she realizes she's left her twin sister back at the line, her older sister back at the line. For sure, they'll think she's dead. This could be the straw that breaks the camel's back for them. They can't keep this up much longer. What's she going to do? She's already gotten away. And then she thinks, "I could not live the rest of my life knowing maybe I could have done something. I'll sneak back." So she sneaks back and lets herself be captured again. She's with her sisters. She explains the two opportunities. They share a witness together. Next day, they're marching. They get to the right moment. They all scatter. This time, she finds a barrel, waits until nightfall. When she comes out, the first thing she's aware of, silence. And no one's around. And that's when she realizes, I'm free. Just like that. All things pass. Walks in town, sister, wonderful reunion. Then they realize, oh, we're freezing. It's January in Germany. Let's go indoors. They go in the house and they find the place is decorated for Christmas. They find the table is set for four as if they're expected with fine china for the holidays. They found food already prepared in the kitchen. That's how quickly the German people evacuated in fear of the Russian army. They just sat down to dinner like they never thought they'd eat again. At the end of the meal, she looks at the fine Rosenthal china. She said, no, I didn't live to wash dishes. They threw the plates out the window, went on to the next house. She said she always regretted not taking service for two. It was Rosenthal. I tell you this because perspective happens right between your ears. If you think somebody's difficult, you're right. If you think you get a result with them, you're right. When you're up against something tough, you breathe, you weigh it against other things, and the energy comes back to do what it takes. And now's the time to go out there and do what it takes. And there's something special about you because, I mean, you know, a lot more people could have even come today, and you know some of the people who should have come today. And but you were the special ones that weren't willing to sit around and whine and complain about how bad everybody is. You're willing to do something about it. So now you're going to go out there and do something about it. And it's really easy. Because the deck is completely stacked in your favor. Because you already know how to communicate and you've got a zillion opportunities every day to practice. The name of the game is to get your reticular activating system focused on what you know and the opportunities. So that's why the book and the audio book is here. If you check out both our websites, there are so many more resources that we didn't even begin to talk about, videos and cult training kits and such. You want to stay in touch with us, you're going to get the Relatives ebook and as well as a meetings article, and then we can let you know of other opportunities. I would also suggest that you come up with a communication partner. This is somebody you're going to meet with once a week and debrief your week in communication. So this is what Rick and I used to do when we first started learning communication consciously. We meet on Friday for lunch, and the only subject we allowed is communication. What'd you notice? What'd you try? What worked? What are you going to do next week? The first week I forgot to pay attention, but I never forgot after that because I knew I was meeting him. If you do these things, there's no way around it. You're going to see what you know. You're going to take the opportunities to practice. And some of the people that today you think are difficult in a week to months will be no-brainers for you. But it's bigger than you because you know what? When you take somebody out of the red zone, you're not just doing yourself a favor. You're also doing them a favor. They're stressed out. You're doing everybody else a favor who would have interacted with them. And if you look at it on a macrocosm, the macrocosm of what countries do with each other is a reflection of the microcosm of what we do with the people we can't stand. Peace as a collective is all of our responsibility. So I urge you to go out there and make a difference. When you're with other people, try to always leave them with a positive message. If you can't think of a positive message, just give them two negative messages. But if I can leave one last thought, let it be this. When you're with a person you can't stand, life is not a test. It's an actual emergency. Thank you and good luck.